This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. All right, so imagine this. You're having a great day. You're walking around putting up posters for an event that you have coming up. And all of a sudden, police officers surround you, handcuff you, and throw you to the ground. And you find out that you've been mistaken for a suspect in a string of muggings, and you come to realize that the rough treatment is just because you're black. In the new Hulu show Woke, this moment changes everything for the main character, Keith. He's about to hit it big with a nationally syndicated cartoon, but his run-in with the law has awakened him to everyday microaggressions and acts of racism baked into society. Here's a clip from the pilot featuring actor Lamorne Morris as Keith.
No. See, I'm not stupid, okay? I know this type of stuff happens all the time. And I know this is going to sound f***ed up, but I just didn't think it would happen to me.
Well, who did you think it was going to happen to, Keith?
Huh? Who? You.
Keith Knight joins us now. He is a nationally syndicated, he's the co-creator and executive producer of Woke and a nationally syndicated cartoonist based in Carrboro. Keith, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Happy to be back.
Congratulations. This is very cool.
Yeah, man. I wish I could be happier. I wish I could celebrate it with the community. I wish I could have a public screening.
Well, and it's celebration and kind of bittersweet in a sense, too, because when you think about the nature of this, you know, the fact that you are able to get this kind of broad platform to do this program and yet the stuff you have to talk about. So give us a sense of the pilot for the show. Tell us about the show.
Well, it's loosely based on an incident that happened to me when I was living in San Francisco. After 10 years, I was hanging up posters for my band, and yeah, I was profiled by the police. Now, in the show, it's a bit more dramatic than what happened to me in real life, but it did make me double and triple down on the work that I was doing about police brutality and racism and profiling in the U.S. that I was doing in my comics, but you know, for the show, we used it as sort of this dramatic turning point. I think it's basically essentially cramming 30 years of my life into an 8-episode season. But you know, it's that moment where your third eye opens and you're like, oh, okay. He learns that he is the sausage. And it's amazing because when you listen to the folks you had on before this, the folks who get caught up in jail and can't pay bail to get out and all that stuff, I mean, that's part of being the sausage, of being exploited and thrown away and forgotten. And so we basically use this platform, this show, to take a look at the macro and microaggressions of race in America and what it's like. Like you can't just be who you want to be. You have to go through maneuver through all this stuff. And you're not taught this when you're a kid.
Well, people who see the show, of course, are going to get all of that from watching, but we have the pleasure and luxury of talking to essentially the author and producer. So give us a sense of what the real situation was like and how that awakening worked in your life.
Well, for me, I mean, there are a couple of times, and I've talked on previous episodes of your show about sort of my woke moments. One of my biggest woke moments was having my first black teacher, and it wasn't until I was a junior in college, and he was an American literature professor, and he gave us to read. Oh, I'm so sorry about that. He gave us to read James Baldwin, Maya Angelou, Richard Wright. And when someone brought up, why are you giving us all black writers? He said, I'm giving you all American writers. And for me, like that was a woke moment where I was like, oh my goodness, we're always taught like Mark Twain is American literature. You know, we've never got these black writers and or Latino writers or Asian writers or Native writers. Like that's when I started to change the work that I did from just being about keg parties and stuff like that to being what it's like to be a black male growing up in America. And that moment with the police, it wasn't so much the police stopping me. It was more my white roommate who came, jumped off the bus, saw me there, jumped off the bus and started getting up in the cops' faces, screaming, getting up in the cops' faces, and the way they treated him as opposed to me. Hmm. Like they treated him as if they were working for him, you know, and calming him down like he was the boss. And that, to me, epitomized white privilege in America. So it was very important for me to really make sure that that part was in the show, too.
Well, and you launched your comic strip in the 90s, right? And so give us a sense of the perceptions of race at that time, or how you saw perceptions of race at that time, and how your work then fit into that landscape.
Well, for me, I came up with the K Chronicles as an answer to, I just didn't see myself represented in the media. So I was a hip-hop fan, and my friends were all hip-hop fans, and whenever they showed anybody who was into rap music, they were like, oh, they're in a gang, they're this, they're that. And I was like, that doesn't reflect any of my friends or any hip-hop fans that I knew. And it was important for me to, like, we're nerds, we're into hip-hop, we're also into other music, we're into politics, we're smart. Like, those things were super important for me to put in the strip. And it just, it resonated with, I don't know if it's a lot of people because I was just running in alternative weeklies, but enough that I was able to put together a career. You know, I've been doing this for 28 years, and so I finally made it big after 28 years of toiling in newspapers. So,
well, tell us more about that. I'm just much more curious too about those the sleeping years, you know, because you talk about being a junior in college, right, and realizing that when African American writers are presented at all, it's in the African American literature class, right? It's not American lit, that sort of thing. And then again, the sense of how white privilege really works in that moment for you in San Francisco. But you're a black man growing up in America, and so there had to be these moments, I'm guessing, you can disabuse me if I'm wrong, but that where you had experienced that and somehow processed it in a way that didn't awaken you, if you see what I'm getting at. Like, what were you doing with those moments until those kind of big epiphanies?
Well, you sort of, I mean, there's a lot of going along with it because you're like, oh, okay. I mean, I just remember just, I don't know, when I was growing up, there were always shows that threw around the N-word all the time, and it wasn't something that myself or my family used the word, and like, so I just, it was awkward for me I didn't talk like that. There were just situations where, I mean, my sister and I went to, when we were in third grade, I think we got transferred to a special school, a special program, where we were the only black kids in the school. And so there were plenty of sort of awkward moments. Man, I remember just, like, I think it was one of the earliest parties, you know, one of those makeout parties where, you know, people dance and, you know, make out in corners and stuff. And there was this debate on whether to invite my sister and I, you know, and like just weird things like that. And we have to deal with that on a constant basis all the time. And it's microaggressions all across the board. Every time I look at any late night television show, I have to sit there and watch a less talented white dude make all this money hosting the show while his much more talented band leader, black band leader, much more talented, plays music and is charming and does all that stuff. But you know they could carry a show on their own. We get microaggressions all the time, these reminders. Why is the NBA logo like some white dude? Like, what is that? And so those are the type of things that we sort of like to poke at in the show.
Well, talk more about the show then, too, and sort of how you transcribe your own experience. But obviously you want to make this something bigger. What was the process like for turning this into not your life?
Oh, well, you know, that's probably where I probably need more therapy. Sitting in a room while everyone talks about you or your character. That's one of the reasons why in the show, it's not Keith Knight, T-H, it's K-E-E-F, Keith Knight. And so we're able to talk about the character in a different way, because there are different things about the character that's different from me. But I told a lot of stories. I think I sold the show on the stories that I told. A lot of them I put in comic strip form, but others I just felt like couldn't be told in comic book form. But they are just great to present in a room. And I think they responded to that a lot. They just thought that my sensibility at addressing these issues was very unique. And so they paired me up with an experienced writer, and Marshall Todd. He co-wrote the original Barbershop. And we got to work, and I was here in Carrboro, and he was in Los Angeles, and we batted around ideas and got to this place where it was important to start it out on the police takedown and have that trigger. What would be interesting visually if a cartoonist, you know, became woke? And we were just like, wow, what if inanimate objects came to life and had this sort of funky style? So we went from there and just built it from there. But I really don't think the show would have been, is like, it's being so well received, at least the trailer is being really well received. And I think it's because the animation in it. Maurice Marable, the directing producer, when he jumped on board, he said, I don't want the animation to be 2D. I want it to be 3D. I want it to be puppetry. I want it to be feel like it's really in the world, like the characters are interacting with. And I think that is so important. And I think it would have looked cheap if it was all 2D. And I just hear from people, and they're saying, and this seems to be a theme with me. People always say, hey, I saw that trailer. It's way better than I thought it was going to be.
That's it, Keith. Keep those expectations low, and sky's the limit. Sky's the limit. You're always happy.
Yeah. And it's happened all. It's happened with my music. It's happened with my comics. And it's just so funny.
Did you ever give thought to, or had you been percolating over or marinating on ideas about a comic? I mean, doing it straight up as a cartoon, or some version of your strip, or some version of this as an animated feature?
You know, I did, but here's a really interesting thing. There's a comedy writer named Tom Gammel. He's like the Forrest Gump of comedy writers. He was at Harvard Lampoon, and then he wrote for the original Saturday Night Live. He wrote for Seinfeld. He writes for The Simpsons. And I met him in Los Angeles, and he's just a really great guy. And he was like, hey, Keith, big fan, you know. And I didn't believe he even knew my stuff. But so I sort of latched onto him as a mentor, and I'm like, hey, man, like, I'm trying to pitch something for television. And this is the advice he gave me. And this is, you know, I think a lot more places are doing it now. But back then he said, Keith, my advice to you is don't pitch an animated show. Pitch a live-action show, he said, because there's only like 5 or 6 networks that will do animation. He said there are about 35, 40 different places that will do live-action. And so, like, from that moment on, I just pitched it as a live-action, and we sold it.
And you sold it.
It was so, I thought it was so crucial, that advice that he gave me. And I thank him all the time. Whenever he writes me, he's like, congratulations, I saw this, I saw that. And I'm like, man, thank you.
And he said, and it was far better than I expected, Keith, having known you as long as I did. Tell me, now I know the real event, and the real life event did happen in San Francisco, but the show is set in San Francisco. Why the decision to keep it there?
A number of things. I think San Francisco, at least back in the day when I was there, was a very enchanting place, and it sort of captured sort of the magical realism that we wanted to get with the animation, and it's where I really made my name as a cartoonist. So it would make sense if I put it anywhere else, and it's just like it's where the incident happened, and I was just there a couple of years ago, and as much as it's changed, as much as like the disparity, they've knocked out basically the middle class in the town, but it still had this magic to it where I could walk across town and the strangest things would happen to me. and you just lean into it and you just have fun with it. And so it was very important for us to set it there. Unfortunately, it was too expensive to shoot there, so we shot up in Vancouver.
Right, you couldn't. A night in a hotel would be actually the budget for most TV shows.
Exactly.
Talk about the timing too, because a lot of folks, I suppose, would say the timing is perfect given what's going on. But I mean, in some ways, this unfortunately, the timing has been perfect for decades, right?
Yeah, I mean, racism and police brutality is evergreen. I would say that the timing of it, we finished shooting the season February 28th of this year, and then everything shut down like a week and a half later. So we so lucked out. But I think, yeah, as far as the timing goes, I think it's just as much about everyone being stuck inside. Mm. It's sort of this complete, because stuff like George Floyd happens so often in this country, I think it was this perfect combination of everybody being stuck in, and having to see this, and they couldn't turn away from it because there was no job to go to, and forget about it, and people were just dying to get out and do something, and they saw the leader of this country not attempt to bring anybody together, but to continue to separate. And I think once people and white people, once white people saw, whoa, like, and we don't have a leader that even cares like that. I think that's what changed this time around.
Keith Knight, co-creator and executive producer of the new show Woke, premieres on Hulu tomorrow, September 9th. Keith, what a pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.